Welcome to Reading Deadly Troubadours. I'm author Brent Thomas, and join with me as I read from the second novel of my Deadly Troubadours series, Sand, Sea, and Stone. Let's begin, shall we? Chapter 6, Day 1, Evening. The Deadly Troubadours had never been to a gala on this scale before. The truth of the matter was that most of the social functions they attended were more on the scale of alley drinks with a few other troops after a successful outing, or, on a grander scale, when someone with actual pull within the order of free thinkers managed to get access to some after-hours eatery where the members of the order were free to gorge themselves on whatever leftovers and treats had been left out. Needless to say, the dress code for such gatherings was non-existent, or at least very relaxed. As long as one's attire was clean enough not to smell offensively, then the dress was deemed appropriate. And yes, there were occasions when the rule had to be enforced. This, an official welcoming ball for the Duchess of Outer Malfenza and her contingency, had standards that were considerably stricter. These standards had posed a bit of a hurdle at the beginning. Not to say that the Deadly Troubadours lacked the proper respect for fashion. Most of them strived for a look that was both elegant and fashionable. However, what was considered fashionable for the streets of Trist might be a touch too eccentric for grand balls behind closed doors. Either that, or not eccentric enough. The easiest fit was Alexander. He dressed simply. Black breeches tucked into knee-length black leather boots with a thick cuff. His wide-collared shirt was the rich blue of a spring sky at midday. His long golden hair was worn loose. It was a simple outfit, elevated by the bard's own attractiveness. To pull the outfit together and give himself the proper air of respectability, he wore a quilted half-cape, which was mostly made of black velvet. Stitched into that field of velvet were square outlines of solid color. Each square was about the size of a hand, and each a different shade. The entirety of the rainbow was represented, but, due to the thinness of the square outlines, rather than being a blinding display of color, the cape came off as subdued and friendly to the eyes. It also accomplished the task of marking Alexander as a bard of the highest order. That he carried with him his mandolin, which he was eager to exercise at the ball, would surely quiet any doubts as to his reason for being there. In Trist, true musicians were always welcome to gatherings, and Alexander was, after all, the master of song. Where Alexander declared himself with colors, Talbert retreated into monochrome. From the waist down, he was dressed the same as his bardic ally. From the waist up, it was a different story. Talbert maintained the discipline of a simple black doublet from which sprang full white sleeves. The doublet was accented with a simple silver chain across the waist and silver pin on its high collar. His hair, with its thick black tight curls, which he was letting go longer and more natural, was held back with a silver band. The effect was that of tame neatness before the band and a small explosion of thick hair after. Despite their differences, there was a similar thread of restraint that ran through the clothing choices of Talbert and Alexander that enhanced the overall impression their respective outfits made. While no one would confuse them with the truly elite members of Trist, they would not look altogether out of place at the evening's ball. On the other hand, Demetrius dressed with the goal to impress. Unfortunately, none of the materials he possessed were all that impressive, and all of it was made up of the fakest kind of gold. Every finger was dotted with a ring, and most rings were dotted with a shiny bauble. That most rings were simple iron covered in metallic paint did not seem to bother the young mage, nor did the fact that the most valuable bauble was a polished piece of sand crystal. The least valuable was a broken hunk of colored glass that threatened to leave a scar before the night was finished. While the rings were certainly eye-catching in their gaudiness, they were only the beginning of his outfit. Every scrap of clothing, from the purple pants to the almost matching purple shirt, was accented with gold-colored cloth hastily sewn along the sides. Completing the outfit was a shoulder piece that looked as if it had been liberated from a junior stage troupe production of The Knight's Torment. Needless to say, that too had been painted gold. An observant eye might have noticed the shoulder piece had been affixed while not completely dry, as there were a few dots of gold visible on the left breast of his shirt. "Maybe if you enter together they will think he is part of the entertainment," Talbot suggested to the musician. Alexander couldn't control the look of resentment that washed over his face, but he cleared it off in an instant and gave a small shrug. "Perhaps I can find a flag for him to hold, or a sparkle torch, something to draw attention away from the outfit," Alec offered. "I don't see why you would waste time thinking about me when you know Kestra is going to be the real problem," Demetria said, obviously overhearing his two friends' comments. "I'm pretty sure Kestra knows how to dress for a formal event," Talbot responded. "Well, knowing how and agreeing to do so are likely two different matters." As if on cue, the lady in question interdressed very much the same as any other occasion. This entailed a pair of sturdy yet maneuverable boots, trousers that fit the same description of a matching color that resembled but was somehow not quite brown, and a simple red doublet with brass buttons. White shirt sleeves poked out from the sides of the doublet, terminating at her biceps. On her hands, she wore fingerless gloves that laced down almost to her elbows. But rather than being the soft and silky things that most men expected to see on a lady's hand at a ball, these gloves carried a weight to them and had a slightly pronounced ridge over her knuckles. In short, they were the gloves of a fighter who was going out expecting a fight. A point that was seized on almost immediately by the others. "Kestra, if you don't mind my asking," said Alexander, who continued without first finding out whether or not Kestra did indeed mind, "are you expecting there to be much punching at the ball? As I understand it, punching is the first sign of a bad party, or possibly the last sign of a good party." "You mean to say that none of you are going in armed?" The three of them looked at her, a little dumbfounded. "Kestra, it's a welcome ball," began Demetrius. "There's going to be dancing and fine, elegant spirits. There's no need to be armed," finished Talbert. Then it was Kestra's turn to stare dumbfounded at her companions. "Need I remind you that this ball is to be for the upper crust of Trist, heads of various well-connected guilds, not to mention the many city officials that will be there?" "Yeah, that's kind of our point," said Demetrius. "Being so well attended," continued Kestra, "it will also be well guarded by the Scarlets. Their Lord Guard Trin will also be in attendance. You might remember Trin as the man who said they are investigating a rumor of a certain dragon being brought to Trist by a group of unscrupulous characters. As we happen to be the characters in question, and I can't shake the certainty that the dragon's child is somewhere hidden away in the golden nightmare Demetrius is calling an outfit, I'm preparing for the possibility of violence followed by a quick escape. How about the rest of you?" There was a moment of silence, followed by the three boys jointly mumbling about needing to grab a few things before they were ready to leave. While they were attending to the last-minute preparations, Kestra took to wondering if the red doublet brought out the red of her hair or struggled against it. She also wondered if the band of gold she wore around her left bicep would stay in place if she needed to punch a few guards in the face. She hoped so. When the last of the preparations were finished, they were off. It was the first elite gathering the deadly troubadours had ever crashed. They had bribed the boyfriend of an acquaintance to get them access to an entrance reserved for party staff and deliveries. When they had brought up the question about whether or not they would be noticed, the boyfriend just laughed. "Of course you will be noticed. It is an expected thing. Just don't knock anything over, and the chef will not care. Chef has more important things on his mind than party crashers. Oh, and don't crush any produce. It was the last part that filled them with the most suspicion. When they arrived at the meeting place, they had their suspicions proved correct. Waiting for them was the boyfriend with a small cart drawn by a rather large goat. You're in luck! Cabbages! You almost had to ride in the tomato cart. That would have been tricky. Come, climb on up. Just behind the driver was a wedge of space held open by some netting. There was decent enough room for two people. That the four of them fit in such a space without too much bickering was a testament to their friendship. Once they were settled, their escort tossed a blanket over the cabbage cart. The blanket gave off a pronounced smell of old produce and human sweat. The cart took off, or rather started slowly, as goats the size to pull a loaded cart are not usually known for their eager temperaments to engage in such labor. It was a slow journey of starts and stops. The thick blanket, combined with the hot night air, gave the troubadours a clue as to how the blanket earned its particular aroma. They were apparently not the first to be smuggled into prestigious events in such a manner. "Just think," whispered Demetrius after at least a quarter hour. "Last year we didn't have the prestige to pull something like this off. We're really moving up in the world." This earned giggles from the other three, including Kestra, who, even under the best of conditions, was a less than cheerful traveler, unless it involved her own two legs. Between giggles, she matter-of-factly stated, "I think I might vomit," which for some reason caused all four of them to go into a laughing fit that they barely got under control when the driver cautioned them, "We are getting close, and cabbage normally does not laugh." The light chastisement served as a reminder of what they were here for, and all the sound from underneath the blanket ceased. The cart stopped. Smatters of conversation was heard. Everything sounded friendly enough. Muscles tensed as the far end of the blanket was lifted. They were still hidden in darkness, but could tell that someone was taking a look at the produce. "Is this normal?" was the unspoken thought on all of their minds. The blanket fell, and the cart started moving again. Within 5 minutes, they came to another stop, and again the blanket was pulled up. Only this time, it was their guide looking down on them. "See? What did I say? No problems. Now, clean yourselves up and get out of the kitchen before the chef gets annoyed. He doesn't like lingering." Even after only this short time in the kitchen, the troubadours could feel the eyes upon them. This was a smooth operating machine, with cooks and waiters twirling in an elaborate dance, ensuring that every bite of every morsel was pristine. The four of them were bits of sand that at any moment could start clogging the works. Even without their guide's warnings, the message of the kitchen was very clear. Get out. And so they did. Exiting a room of controlled twirling perfection into one of chattering, twirling order. The main hall of the ball was very unlike the revelries they were used to attending. There, the partygoers were free to move where and how they liked. Here, despite the open floor for dancing, there seemed to be invisible strings keeping people to their assigned quadrants. It was hard to say what exactly held them in place, but to these outsiders looking in, there seemed to be some sort of agreed-upon ranking that kept the guests in their many little bubbles of freedom. Bubbles where all guests seemed to share similar adornments. Merchants, with their modern styles and hairdos, mingled together, while the bureaucrats, more in simpler, older styles, though still showing their wealth with exquisite accessories, camped out in the next quadrant. There were some exchanges in the centerpiece of these interlocking circles of money and power. Obviously, this was a time of unofficial introductions to be made, and perhaps some official favors to be purchased. Of course, like any party, there were the celebrities. These were noticeable not only to the excellent cut of their outfits and the general attractiveness of the circle, but by the plastic, plastered faces they all wore. Here were the talents of stage and the pioneers of song. Of course, some of the celebrities were only celebrated for their tremendous monies rather than talent, but these were also the stars given the largest of the fake laughs. After all, convincing a moneyed star or starlet to take part in a theatrical endeavors was a surefire way to keep the curtain rising for the next few years. Needless to say, the look that Alexander spared for the musicians assembled in the mix was not one of favor. A curious subgroup of the celebrity circle were the fighters and circle dancers, recognizable by both their physiques and their many scars. While the fights and dances were not as well attended in Trist as they were elsewhere, they were still a prominent feature of entertainment. For some, the life and death struggle inside the rings was far more enjoyable than the fake stories the stage had to offer. What made these fighters stand out was how they responded to their fame. Some were well accustomed to the game of faking interest and were constantly smiling and whispering with prospective patrons. Others were more standoffish and let the aura they presented do the speaking for them. The youngest of them, just boys and girls, really, seemed the most out of place and nervous. Whether this was due to the amount of attention they found themselves in the middle of, or the minders that kept constant, cautious eyes on the young fighter's whereabouts, it was hard to say. Unlike Alexander, who looked upon those of his profession with disdain, Kestra's gaze, when cast at the assembled circle dancers, could easily be viewed as one of pity. "Do you ever miss the circle?" Talbert asked, noticing her look. "Only the tasks left unfinished," responded Kestra. The deadly troubadours had arrived within the first hour of the welcome ball, which was late enough that most of the attendees had arrived, but early enough that the grand introduction had yet to take place. They also assumed it would be early enough not to have missed the entertainment arranged by the Order of Free Thinkers. "I don't know how I should feel," said Demetrius, plucking a glass of wine from the tray being brought around by an impeccably dressed waiter. "How do you mean?" said Alexander, doing the same. "Well, if the presentations go well tonight, that raises the bar of expectations for our performance tomorrow. If tonight's entertainment falls flat, or simply fails, any success tomorrow will seem all the better. I don't know which to cheer for." "The problem lies in how you look at it," Alexander smiled as he spoke, the smile having more to do with the subtle fruitiness of the white wine than in what he was saying. "You shouldn't judge your success against others, not really. Not if you want to be better than you are, rather than just being viewed better than someone else. Does their failure or success make what we have planned any better or worse? If we fail tomorrow, would that make anything that happens tonight greater or lesser? Won't it be seen that way? By some, sure." Alex shrugged and helped himself to a raspberry and honey tart. "But we'll know whether or not we perform to our best. If we do, that is good enough. If we don't, we can learn to be better. I'd rather be judged for what I can do than be compared to someone lesser to make myself look better." "Easy for you to say. You're the master of song, right?" "We all have our burdens." At that moment, the great peal of a gong reverberated throughout the hall. Mirrored lights were aimed and focused onto the far marble stairwell with its grand mouth spanning the width of the hall. The stairwell was designed to look like a giant hourglass, allowing processions to retire from either or both sides. It was large enough to easily fit 100 retainers. From somewhere high above, a baritone voice boomed out, "Your attention is commanded to help celebrate the most grateful privilege we have of hosting the high personage of the Keeper of the Black Diamond, holder of the Veil of Truth, the Most High Duchess of Outer Malfinza, her Ladyship Jatoi." On cue, a rush of bodies began their descent from the wings of the staircase. First came the ceremonial guard, 30 men in brightly colored armor that looked to be made of polished wood interwoven with leather straps, a layer of chainmail peeking out from between the gaps. They wore elaborate helms, all personalized, but based on the same basic design of rounded domes, with the sides and back almost triangular. Underneath, the helmet sat clean-shaven faces, tanned from exposure to the sun and possessing the particular angles often seen in the various regions of Malfinza. Gauntlets and greaves were tied into place and seemed to offer minimal protection. The Malfinzan style of armor was often criticized for offering less overall projection than full mail or plate, but the trade-off was greater speed and agility. This was further exploited by the thin, curved longswords that all Malfinzan knights carried at their side. While it was a third of the size and weight of a broadsword, it sacrificed no cutting power. However, the knights had not come here to debate the value of their arms, but to display a silent competency and menace in protection of their duchess and her handmaidens. And there were many handmaidens, at least 20. They were easily distinguishable from the other attendants and minor dignitaries who'd accompanied the duchess on this goodwill trip. While the others wore the formal yet colorful robes Malfinza was famous for, designs depicting exotic glimpses of fantastical natural views or creatures, the handmaidens were dressed in a plainer fashion. Their colors were those of simple sunset. All wore matching high-waisted and pleated trousers that billowed out, effectively hiding their forms. Over that, they wore something between a coat and a robe, which, despite being fastened, still remained shapeless. While the pleated trousers were on the red side of the sunset spectrum, the coat was more an orange shade. Last came the headpiece, which fell under the burnt yellow category of sunset. Again, the key characteristic was a sense of shapelessness, as if it were made to obscure whoever was underneath. No more than a bit of fabric, it fit snugly over the scalp, and then plummeted down past the base of the neck, and obscuring the face. Except for a strip cut out to reveal the eyes, it was a completely unadorned piece of fabric. With this fashion, all the handmaidens were virtually indistinguishable. They were even of a same height, a height that would be considered on the slight side within Trist. Yet there was something about them, perhaps the way they seemed to take in everything and miss nothing, that made them as intimidating as the honor guard. The contingent on the steps numbered about 80, with roughly 30 being guards and another rough 20 being handmaidens. The remaining were a mixture of officials, minor dignitaries, and those that had the connection to take advantage of a journey to Trist. In the center of it all stood the Duchess. On first glance, it would be easy to assume she was just another of the handmaidens. She was dressed in similar colors and fashion, except for two central components. Gone was the headpiece, allowing the world to look upon her pale skin and dark eyes that were framed beneath thick black hair. Hair that was done up in rows and tresses and adorned with golden pins and exotic silk flowers. She possessed the sharp, cat-like features that Malfinza was known for, and was said to be most pronounced in the residences of Outer Malfinza. The other difference that separated the Duchess from her handmaidens was the level of detail in their outfits. While the level of quality of handmaidens' fabric was unmistakable, they were still plainly colored, although with a slight gradient. By contrast, the Duchess's fabric was embroidered with intricate designs and elaborate patterns, threads not only of gold and silver, but a rainbow of color annotated her own sunset clothes. The skill of the embroidery was not only in the detail, but also in how it never overpowered the eye of the beholder. In this setting, surrounded by her contingent, her presence bordered on the fantastical. She was out of a storybook, but could either be cast as a goddess of nature or as queen of the underrealms. The Duchess walked forward, and a hush fell over the crowd as she readied herself to speak. Just as she began to open her mouth, a loud crash came from the left-hand side of the room. As all eyes turned to see what had fallen, A gasp rose up from the crowd. The Nautilus spirals had begun their act of disruption.
Hey everyone, this is Brent. If you've been enjoying this podcast, there's a few things I'd like you to do to help me out. First of all, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, and then go over to Goodreads. At Goodreads, you can rate and review both Deadly Troubadours and Sand, Sea, and Stone. Then you might as well go on over to Facebook and like the Brent Thomas author page. To see what I'm up to, you can follow me on Instagram or at Twitter. Don't worry about all of those addresses, because you know what? They're all going to be in the show notes at the end. You can also go to my website, which is deadlytroubadour.com. If you really want to support me, you know, with cash, you can go to patreon.com/Brent Thomas. If you want to purchase a copy of Deadly Troubadours, you can get a paperback through Amazon or an ebook anywhere ebooks are sold. Or you can contact me directly for either. Sadly, Sand, Sea, and Stone is not yet available. Thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. And you know what? Have a great day.